Now, KMOX at your service. Welcome to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on KMOX.
And good morning, good Saturday, better weather, home improvement, 2 hours, lots of things to talk about here on University of KMOX. Come on in, plenty of seats right here in the classroom. Come on in, make yourself comfortable. Home improvement, yeah, lots of things right now. 10 phone lines here. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, and toll free 800-925-1120. Yes, indeed, my name is Scott Mosby. We have 2 hours. You are today's agenda item. Yep, your house, all the things around your home, anything around your comfort, perhaps heating and cooling. A couple of things I'll take you through as we do a walkabout around the house. I like to do that every now and again and really just take the pulse of my home. And I encourage you to kind of do the same thing. You and I operating as really consumers, trying to take care of business, just get our home as healthy, reliable, safe, and comfortable as we can. And we do that through this radio show here on KMOX. Been part of the KMOX family most of my life. I welcome you as well. Thank you for listening. I have to confess that, despite the winter or summer, whatever it is, I'm generally grateful to Mike Miller because my yard, after being on KMOX, has been a major improvement. When you're hanging out with Mike and, he's right there, it's kind of handy. The house and the greenery and the stuff around the Mosby Hut, are generally pretty happy for that. But today's agenda, today's show, is the Home Improvement Show. 314-436-7900, 314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. Now, it's just a little bit warmer. We're going to warm up a little bit. We kind of shook off the stuff from last week, but don't miss the opportunity, please. Now that we're inside, we're into the later part of, kind of the winters here. We're into February now. Check that furnace filter. The more we close up the house, the longer time the furnace runs or the air conditioner. Same thing in July as well. When you're working with the extremes on a forced air furnace, most of us have for it, that means air blows out of somewhere as opposed to radiators with steam heat or hot water, whatever it is. If you have moving air, that's a forced air, or you might see it as F/A, meaning forced air furnace. What that means is the air gets heated, gas, electric, whatever the medium is for the energy, and it gets blown around the house. Well, it goes through a furnace filter, just like a coffee filter, not uncommon to that type of thing. But it will catch dust particles. As we run that furnace more, we spend more time closed into our homes, we wind up plugging up and, needing to change that air filter on our furnace, or air handler, as you will. Air handler is the thing that, with the fan, it blows everything around. So now that we're up in the 50s, later on today, take the opportunity also to go outside the house. Take a look at your roof. Take a look at your gutters. Look at the gutters, see if there's anything growing out of there. I know it's chilly and such. Nothing's going to be green, but ideally, your gutters collect the water off the roof, down the gutters and downspouts, and away from the home. If you don't get the water away from the foundation base, then you're going to be calling the sponsor of this show, Helitech, and asking for help around that. So again, the idea of a roof is to shed the water. The gutters are a collection system for that water. And then keep in mind, you and I as homeowners, we need to make sure that water drains, exhausts, or comes out of a downspout or a pipe or something 10 feet away or more or less, whether it's a sidewalk, a driveway, or whatever. Sidewalk and driveway have to slope away from the home. That's important. Make sure that you're getting the water away from that basement. Even if you have a slab on grade, or you have a slab home, radiant heat, you really don't have a basement or any of that, it's important to get that water away. If you have a crawl space, ever more important. For those of you that live with homes over a crawl space, when was the last time you went down there to look at that? Yeah, not exactly in your normal course of the day, but my point is walk around the outside of the house and look for trouble. Look for little signs of problems. A lot of sticks up on the roof might mean that something came down in that snowstorm. We had some pretty heavy snow last few weeks, so unusual things happen. Pick up the sticks around the yard, various things. Be aware of your sidewalk. You might have sidewalk, driveway, you know, slabs moving because of the deep, deep temperatures and the freeze. That soil freezes, and as it freezes, it expands or lifts. So you have what we call frost heave, which means the soil below the ground freezes and it expands, lifts up, and you know, things like driveways come up. We'll talk about that around the garage door here in just a minute. But as it relates to your sidewalk, be aware that you have people coming to your home all the time, one being a postal carrier. Generally, they walk in and out, and it's you and I that are responsible for keeping a safe and passable sidewalk or area for them to get to and from our house. Anything else? You might need emergency services. You get that house all buttoned up and you heat when it's 30 below wind chill. You know, you're pumping a lot of things. Carbon monoxide can be a problem. Please, those of you that don't, I would suggest having a carbon monoxide detector in your home. They're, you know, $30. Buy them at the hardware store. Easy to plug in. They really don't take much. Read the instructions of where they belong, that sort of thing. Smoke detectors, little things like that as well. Also, walking around the outside of your home, pay attention to the screens. I know it's winter time. Sounds counterintuitive, of course. Be aware that getting out in a fire includes your windows and your screens. So if any of you have home inspections, that sort of thing, keep in mind, realize that when they say these screens need to be repaired, also it's an egress or a getting out in an emergency situation as it relates to that walkabout on your home. Think about what's, you know, who's coming and going. It might be, you know, a paramedic. It might be a firefighter. You know, it might be the neighbor. Might be your son and daughter coming to see you, whoever. Just be aware that making that home accessible inside and out is important. Lighting. Lighting is important from the outside and the inside as well. We can talk about that. Several other things around that. Phone lines for you. I'm so lonely sitting down here in this kind of nice studio overlooking Memorial Park and the Veterans Memorial. It's kind of nice. 314-436-7900. 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. I promise we're going to have some more cold weather. It's the early part of February. We haven't made it through this month, so keep in mind the time will come again. The weather's coming. It'll change. If you don't like it here in St. Louis, it'll change soon. So if you get into those extreme temperatures, as I mentioned last week, it's important to open those cabinet doors, run the furnace, get the heat to penetrate deeper inside and under those cabinets where the plumbing pipes are. So those of you that made it last week, congratulations. Those that didn't, you know who you are. My point being that you can run that furnace blower, turn your fan on your thermostat to on. Has two settings, auto, A-U-T-O, meaning automatically come on and off every time the furnace comes on. So it's off most of the time. Or on, which means the furnace blower motor or the fan just runs all the time. It's like a mix master in the kitchen, mixes up the hot and cold air and just kind of circulates it throughout the house and runs all the air past that furnace filter we just talked about a few minutes ago. So anyway, just be aware that keeping your house healthy, warm, comfortable, and safe, and that includes lighting things up. I'm a very early riser. Sometimes I get up 4 o'clock in the morning and I walk around and I'm generally in the dark. So I know where things are and I'm aware of lighting, but there's soft lighting and reference points. Keep in mind that for you and your home, you also depend on things that way. 314-436-7900, 800-925-1120. My name is Scott Mosby. We have 2 hours today. This is the KMOX Helitech Home Improvement Show. I am at your service. We'll be back for phone calls right after this on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, once again, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on KMOX.
All right, welcome back. Hour one, home improvement, 2 hours today. Phone lines open for you, 314-436-7900, toll-free 800-925-1120. My name is Scott Mosby. I own Mosby Building Arts. It's a local remodeling company. We are licensed architects, full home remodelers. We do home projects, residential remodeling, quite a bit of high-rise condos, that sort of thing. The more difficult the project is, that typically is kind of where we are. We're on the architect end of projects. On the other end of the scale, there are, for example, we've got a seminar coming up this next Saturday, so stay tuned. That's at the MAC, Missouri Athletic Club West, there on DePere Road, and that's at 10:30 in the morning. You can RSVP at callmosby.com if you'd like. There you're going to see about full, you know, true full-scale remodeling kitchens. The other one is a right kitchen, or where cabinets, countertops, appliances, and floor, pretty much that, you know, what you see gets changed. And that's a simpler project. So we call that a right kitchen, whereas design build tends to be we're moving walls, replacing plumbing, rewiring the things. All the, anyway, it's kind of fun. Kitchens are a blast. I mean, they really are exciting because everything is a finished project. Everything is a finished material. Anyway, so much to talk about there. But if you'd like to attend, it's next Saturday, MAC West, 10:30 in the morning. Check out the website, callmosby.com, and under seminars, the top tab there. Just click under that, and there are other ones coming up to you as well. So just give you a little in March, next month is exteriors. April gets into bathrooms. Then in June, lower levels. Later on in July, kitchen. So anyway, just part of the CAMWEX outreach. It's important for us to be there with the information. Let's go to the phone lines. Fire them up. Bosco back there on the treadmill making 50,000 watts come out true. Let's talk with Chris. Hey, Chris, good morning. Thanks for getting us started here on CAMWEX. How can I help?
Good morning, Scott. About 2 years ago, I had a new metal roof put on my house. Mm-hmm. And the first year, we didn't notice any leaks or any problems, but last summer, we started noticing moisture coming through the insulation. And so this fall, we actually tried to call the contractor half a dozen times to come out and look at it, but we never got a return call. So this fall, my husband crawled up underneath the insulation to see if he could figure out where the leak was coming from. And we find that not only do we not have a moisture barrier, but the contractor put the metal roof right on top of the rafters. So we have rafters and insulation and ceiling. So we don't think we have a leak. We have moisture built up condensation over the course of time. Mm-hmm. When my husband looked at it, there were actually icicles hanging from the metal roof itself. So my question is there a way to fix this, or do we have to take the roof off and start over again with deck moisture barrier and metal?
Well, I'm surprised that there's no decking. It is common to have an OSB-oriented strand board plywood, something up there, in a felt paper or some water membrane underneath any roof. So that I'm disappointed to hear that. The metal roof it does not absorb moisture. So as soon as there's a moisture accumulation anywhere, especially in an attic, that cold metal is going to condense and the icicles. We've actually seen snowstorms up in attics. So you're not alone. This is a ventilation, an attic ventilation issue. And this gets into, the metal roofing guy knows roofs, but if he doesn't know attics and ventilating attics, you know, it's kind of like a podiatrist, you know, a foot doctor not caring what happens on the rest of the body. You know, it's like, well, I've got a really good foot, but the rest of the guy died, you know. So, you know, again, you have to have some awareness of what's happening outside your direct scope of responsibility. Bottom line is, some ventilation for that attic cavity has to happen. Let that moisture escape. The ambient humidity, basically you need a cold attic. If you have an attic, the insulation should be, down at the ceiling line, and that's where the weather barrier is, or the envelope, what's called the insulated envelope of the house. Everything up in the attic should be as close to exterior conditions as possible. So if it's 50% relative humidity and 50 degrees outside, the closer your attic is to that, the more closer to perfect or optimal it is. When you close in an attic and don't put ventilation on, sounds like your roofing contractor didn't put any kind of vents on, because on metal roofs they tend to be pretty unattractive. And by not having a sheathing up there, plywood, OSB, or decking material, he may have thought that, you know, I really don't need. Well, obviously your husband discovered that's not true. So you're trapping relative humidity. You don't need to bring the humidity in. St. Louis provides it right in the air in relative humidity anyway, 50%, 70%. You get it cold enough, you get a snowstorm and icicles, which your husband discovered. So it's a ventilation problem. Venting has to be added. Do you have any overhang on this roof, any kind of a soffit or anything there by the gutters?
Yes, there's quite a bit of overhang.
Oh my, are there any holes in that overhang, any kind of venting for air coming in?
Not right now.
Okay, that, frankly, again, a good roofing contractor, any kind of roofing, metal, composite, asphalt, whatever it is, would have this conversation with you and say, you know, I can put a rock solid metal roof on, you'll love it, it'll look great, but you know what, to avoid some other issues, we need to, you know, ventilate your soffit. We need to open that up, put some ventilation in so that the air, the attic then can inhale. And then on the top of the roof, I need something like, you know, some whirly bird vents, you know, those ugly things that spin on the roof.
Right.
And then you've got pan vents that stick up, and then you've got this ridge vent. There's all kinds of ways to let that air at the top escape. But the bottom line here, Chris, is inhale at the bottom. Basically, the sun warms up that air, and you get hot air rises, and it just escapes out the top. With it, it takes that excess moisture, or the stagnant air that now is trying to, you know, turn into icicles and snowstorms. So a properly ventilated attic generally has enough moving air. You don't ever start a snowstorm, and you don't get those icicles. But by golly, you're not alone. We see this and actually have all kinds of photos of it at Mosby Building Arts as well. It's like, hey, man, let me show you the one I saw today. So ventilation is important. And at this point, I think you're going to need, you know, a 9 or 10 out of 10, somebody to analyze what you need to see if there's a way to keep this roof and do it right. Chances are there's 70, 80% chance the roof is fine, but you're going to have to cut some holes in that beautiful roof and put some vents on, which are inherently a little less attractive.
So the portion of the roof that we're having difficulty with is, I'll call it a shed roof. It's over a kitchen, which was an addition. Mm-hmm. And so there's really no attic there. I'll call it a crawl space. It has a very low, the roof has a shallow grade.
Low profile.
Yeah. Low profile. Okay.
Sure.
So
okay.
Towards the outer edge, there's not much gap between the insulation and the roof. But on the house side where it attaches to the house, there's probably maybe 24 inches from the top of the insulation to the roof. If we put vents on those sides, would that help?
The problem with this, Chris, is there usually isn't enough depth to get enough R value out of the insulation. So inherently, whether it's any kind of a roof, when you get those low sheds, you're flirting with spray foam, really high performance insulation to get this thing done.
Okay.
Because if you put fibrous insulation in there, you know, to get an R30, you need 13 to 15 inches of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, how are you going to get that down by the gutters on a shed roof? You just can't. So you're really, you know, one of the byproducts of re-roofing that, and this kind of gets into the Mosby difference, you know, we might have suggested opening up the roof, spray foaming the ceiling from the top down, sheathing it before the roof went on, you know, and then people think that's crazy and overkill, and out the door we're asked to go. But the point is that it is an insulation issue. When you have not much space, mm-hmm. and the same insulated envelope issues, you've got to do a lot with a little. And when you're doing a lot with a little, that means expensive materials and labor and that, you know. So I might suggest at this point, anyway, give somebody a call to come out. I think you're flirting with pulling the drywall or ceiling down in the kitchen and spray foaming something up in there to make this happen. Or you're peeling back that metal roof on the shed part, spraying it from the top down, which would be the most effective way, just not the least costly at this point. But you've got to get a lot of insulation in a small area, and still do some enough ventilation. So there's got to be some space over the top of that foam or whatever. But you, when you get in those shed roofs, you know, and then you start putting recessed cans and can lights in there, oh my gosh, you know, you're flirting with fire. You know, you're messing with you just a lot of building science problems, 10 pounds of problem in a 3-pound space. So you need a pretty smart bird to come out there and, you know, take a look-see at this, I think.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, you're welcome to give Mosby a call on that. This is the kind of thing some of the really better home inspectors can do this as well. But for the most part, this is pure building science. You know, when you look back on it, when you hear the answer, it'll be, well, of course, that's just common sense. Well, you know, physics are just common sense. But, you know, doing it on the front end sure beats trying to figure out why the patient died. So.
Right, and, right.
Yeah.
So we've got to get a spray foam insulation in there, either taking the roof off and putting it in, or taking the ceiling and the insulation and putting it in.
Yeah, there may be other options here, Chris. I'm just saying that you're into, you passed the cheap choices already. You're into, even if you hadn't put the roof on, all these things that I'm advocating now that you'll hear from, you know, the right visitor should be done or should have been done. And choosing not to do it means I'm just going to get icicles in my attic. But, you know, anyway, just
right.
Yeah.
Well, we have moisture coming through the ceiling into the room. So, I mean,
right.
it's more of just icicle problem. So we need to fix it.
Yes, yes. And this is pure building science. This is just physics. But when you try and get a lot of insulation and performance out of a small space, you know, you're into the, you know, high performance materials and high cost materials, you know, to get that stuff done.
Right. Okay. All right. We'll give you a call. I appreciate you.
Yeah, Chris, you had enough sense to ask the question. You know, I mean, frankly, that's, you know, kudos to you. So anyway, it all makes sense when you hear the answer, but going in on the front end, I would, you know, our industry is needing some education, let's put it that way.
Right, I appreciate that.
Okay, Chris, take care.
Right. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. All right. Hey, folks, tonight we've got the Blues playing right here on KMOX. You know, I got a 6 p.m. game with Columbus, so, you know, stay tuned. We have an afternoon of experts, lots of things happening. Bosco here is going to take a break after the home improvement show. You know, he's a trooper. You know, he runs on that treadmill, turning that little whip. Yeah, you don't really take me seriously. Home Improvement, 314-436-7900, 436-7900, toll-free, 800-925-1120. Scott Mosby at your service, back for more after this.
Welcome back to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, once again, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on KMOX.
Okay, we had a couple of questions here off the air anyway. Sidewalks, concrete, anything moving and settling in the wintertime, generally it will come up, won't necessarily go back down. Most of the cracks in garages, and you all know it, there are cracks in your garage, that is from frost heave. Sometimes the floor goes down after it cracks, but most commonly that is from a really cold winter and the concrete gets pushed up by the freezing soil below, the cracks ensue, and then it relaxes back down. And, you know, once concrete's cracked, it's just cracked. It's not going to go back and heal itself like, you know, ourselves, our bodies do. So anyway, concrete moves, and for those of you that have pinching doors, you may actually have an entry door, an outside door, you know, back door, front door, whatever it is. If there's some sort of a stoop or concrete slab that is poured on the soil and it gets lifted up by this freezing cold temperature we had last week, very common, and it doesn't thaw out down there very quickly. Thermal swing, once it takes days for that cold to penetrate the soil, and it takes days for that warm-up to happen as well. So you may still have a tight door, though, even though it's 50 degrees coming up today. Anyway, that is from the concrete slab coming up. Garage doors, if you're putting the garage door down and it automatically closes, boom, hits the bottom, turns around, goes right back up, it's usually needing a slight adjustment because your concrete floor or your driveway, whatever that surface is that the door comes down on, is probably a quarter of an inch higher than it was last month. And the door is adjusted and built and sensored for if there's a dog or you or some problem down there or a kid, that thing turns around, goes right back up on a safety reverse mechanism. So just be aware there's a little bit of adjustment necessary. It may even need to be readjusted in the spring, but it comes from moving slabs. Let's go to the phones and talk with my friend Diane. Hey, Diane, good morning. Welcome to KMWX. How can I help?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I'm actually calling on behalf of my mother, who has a six-month-old American Standard gas water heater. Mm-hmm. And the water heater is making a very strange sound. It's like a foghorn sound that starts kind of soft and then it gradually grows in intensity, and you can hear it through the whole house.
Yeah.
It happens at random times, and okay. We've had repair people out three times. It's under warranty, but they never find anything wrong with the water heater. And I have actually followed the sound right to the water heater. I know it's okay. coming from the water heater, but at this point, the warranty company won't do anything because these repair people, even though they're certified techs, first he replaced the fill valve in a toilet upstairs. Next time he said, well, the pressure valve on the water pipe needs to be replaced. And I know it's not coming from there. It's coming from the water heater.
Hmm. Is there a blue tank about the size of a propane tank? Is there
yes, it has an expansion tank, yes.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. That's interesting. They're following a pretty good progression of things that need attention. A shutoff or a valve usually is the culprit for this. If you've followed it right back to the water heater, you know, the two shutoff valves above that, it sounds like they've addressed that, you know, a toilet. Long and the short of it is that toilet valve probably need to be replaced anyway in the next 3 years. So, you know, you're at least improving things that way.
Right.
When you get it back to the water heater, I don't know. The way we tend to handle things like that is we generally, when we're out of options, do the most obvious dumb thing, which might be replacing that water heater, and see if maybe it is.
We can't get the warranty company to understand that nobody seems to be able to fix this, and they refuse to even pay for another certified tech to come out.
Well, the first thing, Diane, I would change that expansion tank because there's a valve, there's air in or water in and water out of that expansion tank, and these things are not built by NASA. You know, I mean, they're high quality,
yes.
They're plumbing fixtures, but these things are not triple redundant quality. So, you know, anything humans can make, they can mess up. You know, none of us have been nailed up on the cross for a while that I'm aware of. So my point being, you know, do the obvious dumb thing because they've done the pretty smart things. And this may be incumbent on you. You may have outrun the commitment of that company, although it sounds like they've done pretty well. But I would start with, you know, before I spend another $1,000 or $1,500 on a water tank, I'd try a new expansion tank. We get into this every now and again with name brand shower valves because the more high-tech performance-based they are, the more cool things they have, which means the more cool things can go wrong. You know, so we've had pressure regulating valves at the front of the house that with this particular brand of shower valve makes that sound you're talking about. We change the pressure regulator, sound stops. Who would have thought that?
So the So the pressure regulator on the water pipe, you would recommend that we go ahead and have that replaced because that's at our cost. It's like $360 or something like that.
I wouldn't necessarily do that. The problem is you have to go to the high end. There are some brand new pressure regulators that are from a name brand, but they're not the top of the line, and they they can actually create this problem. So if you're going to get a new pressure valve, make sure you go to the top of the food chain on product quality there. But I personally, you know, and this is real neophyte non-plumbing stuff, but, you know, just from a process of elimination, I like that they've done the shutoffs. I like that they went to the toilet, you know, and I'd kind of keep going on that and just try changing that expansion tank and the valves around that. You know, because it's unlikely. The water tank, the water heater is really just a tank. So I understand where they're coming from. It's not likely that big water heater. But I can, you know, there are five or six things around it that got changed at the same time.
What's your opinion on this? I did a little research, and I did find an instance where the gas orifice was out of alignment, and somebody had blogged about it, and there's apparently like a little aluminum disc that can get off center under the burner.
Yes.
But I sort of approached that with the repairman, and he just looked at me like I was nuts. So I wasn't too sure how to persist on that.
You're just a homeowner. You couldn't possibly be right.
Well,
I've been there before where that homeowner who couldn't possibly be right was right. You know, so some of it is just how you handle consumers and manage through this thing. Usually that gas valve, when you get something off or whatever, you wind up with high whistling sounds from, you know, that gas. And unlikely that it's a foghorn sound. And that foghorn actually can happen or originate somewhere else and still sound like it's coming from the water heater because it resonates throughout the whole house. So you're isolating it down to the water heater has value.
Yes.
Doesn't mean you're right or accurate, but by golly, you're valuable in looking for it because you're it's your house. You deal with this all the time. Just personally, I would continue eliminating the peripheral things around that tank, one being an expansion valve, and how we go at it at Mosby is, you know what, I'll tell you what we'll do. We're going to progress with these things. We are creating value as we do it. If we do find that it's the water pressure regulator on the front of the house that is this, when we replace it, if that fixes the problem, would you be willing to pay for that piece? So it's kind of like, you know, we're going to keep with this process. We don't really know who or where this is going to be. But I would suggest that this remain with a process of elimination because on that foghorn, what kind of a pipe hammer, something.
Yeah, it's almost like a tornado siren.
Baby, I know what you mean. Hopefully it doesn't happen in the middle of the night because it'll wake up the neighborhood.
And my mom's like 85 and she's, you know, this is stressing her out, and I've been trying to deal with it for her, but it's such a frustrating process.
Yeah. Well, you may wind up for on your own nickel doing whatever it is because responsibilities or, you know, you're welcome to call the Better Business Bureau if you'd like to lodge a complaint with that. That's a good place to do that. But generally people, you know, with a better company, they'll stick with you until they figure this out. It's not fun on either side of this. I know I've been on both sides of this. So, but by golly, until you run it to ground, that's how you learn. And, you know, a lot of ways, that's how I wound up on the radio is I've messed up a lot of things and I figured them all out.
Well, I appreciate that feedback because it has been frustrating, but we'll just stay the course until we get it figured out.
Yes, ma'am. If you get, you know, you're welcome to call our office and, you know, you don't have to do this on public radio, you know, where we're out on the airwaves, but we'll give you our best suggestions. And, you know, there are some analytical plumbers out there. They're plumbers that install stuff and then they're guys that figure things out. So we may be able to give you the name of a few of those.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay, Diane. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Home Improvement, stay tuned. An afternoon of fun on CamWix. As usual, my golly, I can't believe they let us all talk on the radio and say these things. No, never mind. They haven't. They're adjusting my medication. I should be better any moment now. Hey, we have some phone lines open. 314-436-7900, 436-7900, 800-925-1120. You're up here on KMOX right after this.
Welcome back to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, once again, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on KMOX.
All right, welcome back. Home improvement, so many things to talk about here. Hey, we had a caller call in with a little help for Diane, a suggestion. Sounds like we may have a plumber that's trying to help Diane. She had the American Standard gas water heater, foghorn sound. One of the suggestions was check the anti-knock chamber. A little bit outside of my realm, but I'm passing it on because that's a responsibility and the commitment here from Camo X and me. Try, Diane, something about the anti-knock chamber. Anyway, over my badge level. Next up on the phones, let's see what's cooking with Bob. Hey, Bob, good morning. Welcome to Cam Wex. How can I help?
Scott?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a question. We have in our basement, we had a corner of our basement that we've just, for years, had water issues. Place the gutters. It's where there's a patio, so I have no idea where the water could be coming from. I'm assuming it's just groundwater. We had people come out. We've tried sealing it, and it's kind of stopped the leak, but it's still sweat, you know, and it turned, you know, colors like it was damp. So I finally got tired dealing with it and couldn't find anybody that really could solve it. So I ended up, that's going to sound probably crazy, taking a half-inch copper pipe, driving it through a crack that formed, and then sealed up everything else. And it's been that way. And maybe once a year when it really, we have days of rain, that water will actually drip out of that pipe. But other than that, the rest of the wall is perfect. You know, no more moisture, no, it's painted and it never shows any kind of water damage or anything else. My question to you is, it's probably not code or whatever, and we're thinking of selling the house. Is that going to be an issue for me, you think? To sell the house?
First off, you did pretty much what a drain tile or a hydraway would do. You basically let the water come in. You relieve the pressure on the other side of the wall. So instead of the water trying to run around and find every little crack and come in, you just made it a better offer. Here, if you're going to come in my house, come in here. So you relieve that pressure on the other side. That's effectively what happens when you put the drain tile in the basement. Now you're at the place where you've pretty much, kudos, you've identified where the problem is. But then, is that something that a new homeowner is willing to live with, and how much are they going to charge you for it in purchase price for that versus having somebody put it in with a warranty? So again, I don't know. Beauty's in the eye of the buyer, but that's why many of these basement waterproofing projects and systems get installed, is so that problem doesn't transfer to the next homeowner. So you're in a pure consumer transaction there. I suspect when you start talking to a real estate agent to list the home, you'll get some valuable advice there. I think, you know, for a guy like me buying that house, I look at it and say, boy, that's great. I know exactly what it is. I'm comfortable with that. But the less knowledge that the home buyer or homeowner has that's buying this home, the more they're going to want somebody else to buy the insurance and solve that problem so they don't have to. So you're in just a pure consumer question. So my answer is yes. I suspect your real estate agent is going to say spend the X number of dollars and get it fixed, because they're going to charge you that plus fear money on how much to fix it, because they're just going to figure out what does it take to get that put in, and then how much you're going to pay me for my trouble. So
okay,
that's my
two things. Yeah, well, one, we do have a floor drain in the drain tile around the base.
Okay.
That did not solve, you know, I mean, it drains. We have a sump pump and the rest of it basement is dry as can be. But that one corner, it was basically the whole length from floor to you know, top of the foundation that it would get moisture, you know. And so I guess the dilemma I'm in, what I did worked and solved the issue. I could pull that pipe, patch that hole, and paint over it, and, you know, it might not ever come back. I don't know, but I guess my issue is, am I hiding something, you know, that when I leave, that could be an issue for the new homeowners.
Well, first off, if you've got drain tile, they didn't connect the dots. I would pull back that cement at the corner, drill those holes at the base of the foundation. If that doesn't do it, there are typically plastic sheets that go over the face there to let the water come through where your hole is that then carries it down to the drain. So there are ways to do this. If you've already paid for the answer and you're not getting the value, that's one issue. Number two, when you go to sell this house, you're going to sign a legal document that says that I haven't hidden a thing. What you see is what you get, and I know of no issues that are not right. Apparent, you know, so now you're flirting with the fraud thing. So you're going to wind up in a place where you're going to have to sign this thing and disclose this anyway. So this is, in my opinion, still your problem one way or the other.
All right,
but I would go back to that drain tile company. It's like, by golly, why is the water not getting down into your nice, cool system?
Hello?
So, yeah, I'm with you there.
Yeah, that was done before we bought the house. I mean, when we bought the house, the original owners.
Well, Bob, I'm running out of time. I'm sorry. Okay, I got to go now.
Thank you for your time.
All right, brother. Thank you. Bye now. Stay tuned. More on KMOX.
Now, KMOX at your service. Welcome to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on KMOX.
All right, welcome to Hour 2, Lunchtime KMOX, University of KMOX, classroom space here. Sometimes I'm the instructor, sometimes I'm the student. Either way, what goes around comes around. We are talking about all things homes, home improvement, and the values thereof. It's important to keep in mind, we're all just trying to keep ourselves safe, comfortable, and healthy in our homes. That is the mission of today's show, the KMOX Home Improvement Show. This is the Helitech Basement Foundation and Waterproofing Home Improvement Show. They sponsor the show, make it possible for me to come here, answer the questions, and exchange the knowledge, sometimes from our listeners, exchanging from other listeners, sometimes from my experience, and oftentimes just, some ideas, some of the things that I've learned here over the years. Number one, things that have been knowledge-based for hundreds of years, like removing lime deposits with vinegar. I come from the professional end of things. Sometimes I can overly complicated things, my industry included as well. So cleaning a lime or mineral deposit off of the inside of a slow flushing porcelain toilet bowl. Yeah, just pour some muriatic acid down there, swish it around, it'll work. Well, it does. Muriatic acid is actually hydrochloric acid. So, you know, I know it works. It won't really hurt the porcelain. Listener calls up and said, hey, Scott, you know, you don't need to use that nasty stuff. Just put some vinegar down there, swish it around, and let it go. It may take a little longer than the muriatic acid. Just, you know, try the vinegar. Now, part of parson parcel of this show and my answers is the magic of the low-grade acid content of household vinegar. Yeah. Shower heads, white buildup deposit. They don't spritz out quite the way we want them. My wife and I routinely go through the house, put little Ziploc bags, dump a little household vinegar in, you know, just from the grocery store. Hang it on the shower head, a little twist tie, sometimes as clever as a rubber band. Let it hang on there for about a day. Generally, if you have an old metal shower head, it can eat the chrome off, so beware. One size does not fit all, but vinegar does work. Spritz it through, clean out the filter screen on that shower head as well, and you have everything working back again. As I responded in terms of, or discussed with the toilet bowl, if you're in a high mineral content and you have buildup of lime or such, hard water typically, water well, that type of thing, there can be a slow buildup of lime, and it deposits on that slick porcelain bowl. no matter how good a homeowner and home cleaner you are, that deposits a very low, almost like a sandpaper finish. So the swirling water in your toilet bowl swirls slower, gathers mineral and material less effective, and goes down more slowly, and it's just less effective. Put a little vinegar in there, slosh it around. I mean, you know, no big deal. Make sure you get it up underneath the rim where those little holes come out, and you dissolve the mineral deposit, and you slick the bowl back to a fast spinning swirl and a more effective flush on your toilet. Where else can you go to talk about the operation of a commode? You know, I mean, life's good here on KMWX. Simple pleasures for simple minds. I've never been accused of being, you know, stoically intelligent, but by golly, I've got my share of common sense. Yeah, I've got some friends that challenge that as well. Well, we can talk about that and more here on KMWX. 314-436-7900. 314-436-7900. 800-925-1120. The one thing I love about this show is what I learn. Maybe you could call in and share some of that as well. Some of the things you've learned over the years on KMWX. I can't even remember them all, but they're there somehow when people ask me these questions. My responsibility is to take the best answers and get them to the best questions, line them up the best I can, and then sometimes, you know, the toughest thing I do is when I have an answer to a question, and I know it's could be a lot more accurately correct. You know, how do I use that? But anyway, as we now exchange, I think we've got a caller calling in here, perhaps about some water heater. Diane, by golly, we're going to circle the wagons, and you know, the University of KMWX, family of KMWX, is going to get the best to you. I think we've got Mike on the line. Mike, welcome to Hour 2 Lunchtime on KMWX. Do you have something you can offer and help us?
Hey, hi, Scott. Actually, I was calling about a water heater question, but I would say to Diane, those things are only about $40, I think, and that would be the expansion tank. That would be a cheap starting point to They just screw on and off generally, I would think. So, but anyway, hey, I had a question. Are you two topics? Are you familiar much with those? So my kids bought a new old house, and they have one of these fancy, I don't know if that's called an instant water heater or whatever, but it's gas. It looks pretty impressive. We're just not used to it. Do you have to run that water before you? Seems counterintuitive that it's an energy-saving device, but you got to run water for 30 seconds before, or better, before you get hot water. We didn't know. I checked the little filter in there. Haven't gone through that flush cycle stuff because the filter was spotless.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with those much?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the math itself will explain to you the 30 seconds of cold water. An instant hot water heater or on demand, which means there's no hot water until that puppy fires on. So an instant hot water heater does not even turn on until the water starts flowing. So you've got cold water coming in, and then it's usually installed in the location where the old water heater, the tank water heater, was. So that tank water heater also had 30 seconds of cold water before it got to that faucet, because the water heater's on one end and the faucet calling, you know, for the demand is on the other end of the house. So that water heater doesn't even turn itself on, and it's a blowtorch. Think of it as a blast furnace that's trying to heat water really fast. It's effective at it. So the reason it's an energy efficient device is it's not burning anything until somebody turns on hot water. But if you've got a house pipe where you still have 40 feet of pipe, and on a two-story home it may only be, you know, a few feet away, but the pipe may be 45 or 50 feet, you may have 30 seconds of water flowing before any water from any hot water tank gets there. So this thing has about 2-3 seconds to fire up and get to heat, and so now everything's coming as long at the flow rate it's designed for. As long as that thing's calling for hot water, it'll just keep on heating. So, you know, for a year and a half, you'll get continuous hot water at that flow rate. But it doesn't address still that fixture, that faucet or shower, being too far away from the water heater.
I got you. So,
got it there. Okay. Same old, same.
They just need to get used to it.
And I mean, especially, I thought, well, gosh, you know, for young families, this is a magical thing. Well, for old guys like me that generally takes one shower in the morning and I don't use a whole lot of hot water, my wife and I, you know, it's like for an empty household, that's pretty good because it does not keep anything warm. So you're using zero energy. That's the shtick on how it's so energy efficient.
I got you. That's okay. Good to know. And then, so they also have an unfinished attic, but it has a stairway from the first floor, which is nice, you know, a conventional stairway. Right now, all they want to do is, they may finish it down the road, but they want to drop some plywood in there for storage. So for a floor, I assume you use 3/4 inch. We don't want to put down 1/2 inch for Christmas decorations, and then 2 years from now I have to tear it up. But for a good floor up there, you'd use 3/4, I'm guessing.
Well, I'm going to put a, you know, my big T and a little 2 hands there, timeout, like on a basketball court. Just because you've got stairs up there, that means somebody wanted to go up and inspect their attic on a regular basis comfortably. That does not mean that the ceiling joists were designed to carry any kind of weight load. So even the building code has become very specific that installing even drop-down stairs today requires that the floor joists go up to a thicker, taller, heavier load potential. So just because you and I put boxes up there, that, you know, I sell the house and Mr. and Mrs. Smith start storing books up there. Well, that's the problem. So my first choice, before you do anything else, is call an architect or a structural engineer. Even a good contractor generally knows what size and wood structures, you know, the floor joist needs to be. And the difference between a ceiling joist, which means just enough to hold up insulation and some drywall, that's different than a floor joist, which means it'll carry all my furniture, my stuff, my bed, and me walking across it. So just because you've got a house that has an old set of stairs in there, I guarantee it does not. And these are problems because, you know, we're a responsible contractor. That's one of the first things we do is check whether that structure can handle it. And 9 times out of 10, it won't handle any kind of a live load or storage load. So be careful. Start first with an engineer or architect.
Okay. Can I give you a call Monday and get some recommendations on that?
And wood structures, residential houses, this isn't really rocket science. To get a pretty close answer, that's one thing. To get a sealed structural engineer, you're going to pay $400, $500, you know, for that answer. But it's going to be the same. You know, a good carpenter's been framing these things for years. They know what the sizes are. But just because you have stairs doesn't mean this thing can be finished off at all.
That was my next question on even the weight of that plywood, if that was going to be okay. So you answered that.
And generally for a live load substructure, the answer to your direct question is 3/4 inch, because at 16-inch centers, which probably is that old ceiling joist pattern or spacing, you know, when we put down 1/2 inch as sheathing, we also put another 1/2 inch diagonally or across it, so it had a 1 inch thickness total. Now the 3/4 tongue and groove is what really replaced those 1/2 and 1/2 or 1/2 and 5/8 or 1/2 and 3/4 subfloor pieces. So direct answer, 3/4 inches or more, usually tongue and groove, but be careful. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Beware. You can have some real collapse issues and dangerous things too.
Okay. Well, while we're on the attic subject, if you don't mind, so I have to look again today. These are either, maybe they're 8-inch two bys up there. So to insulate, we were thinking about blowing it in for now, but where they wanted to do their storage, of course we had to roll some, he rolled out, I think it's R19. If you double that up and you just crush it down, that probably doesn't do much for you.
No, because it's the trapped air in between the fibers that does the insulation. So if you squish it down and squeeze all the air out, you don't have the insulative qualities of it. So, yeah, it's not the fiber that does the insulating. It's the air that gets trapped between those fibers.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Okay, so just as much as we can put in there without crushing it.
Yeah, you may, and in a 1 or 2 by 8, you know, 7 1/4 tall or so, you may need to laminate some rigid foam over the top of that and get something, you know, you may need an R10 on top of that R19 in between there just to get close, because you're probably not going to put insulation on the top of the plywood. So, you know, or fur up the joists. Again, make them thicker so you have more fibrous insulation in there, and on and on and on. So, yeah,
but
you just can't squeeze
it. Foam board.
Yep.
Can go on top of it.
Usually, the pink or the Dow. The pink, which is the Owens Corning, and the blue is the Dow. Those are high performance. Usually, about R5, 5 1/4 per inch. You get a 2-inch. Panel in there, and it's structural enough you can store things on top of that with ply. So that would go on the joist, and then the plywood goes on top of that.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
All right. Well, check that out. I appreciate the info.
Yeah, get an engineer or architect in there, because there are a lot of things. As you start putting that foam in there, you may need to ply wood at first, then foam it, then ply. You know, there's you know, I flirted with a lot of danger in those answers there, so beware.
No, I got you. Yeah, then it's, just because it has stuff doesn't mean it's viable. So, okay. Well, thanks a lot, Scott. Appreciate the show.
Okay, Michael. Take care. Okay. Home Improvement, KMOX. Stay tuned. So much more coming here on University of KMOX.
Welcome back to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, once again, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on KMOX.
All right, Scott Mosby here in the studio right here on the corner of Intercom at the KMOX Studios. Beautiful day. Excuse me, getting a little warmer as I speak. There's hope for us yet, folks. I mean, by golly. Did anybody, you know, kind of hold their finger up when it was 30 to 40 degree wind chill this week, you know, trying to figure out which way the wind blows, and, you know, in 20 seconds your finger came down with, you know, frost? Woo, yeah. Well, we're not there today. Tomorrow's going to be quite the day, I think, pick of the litter for the weekend. But we have phone lines open, and I'm sitting here waiting for you. 314-436-7900, 436-7900, 800-925-1120. An opportunity, really, now just to talk about lighting. There have been so many changes in lamps, L-A-M-P-S, like lamp, and you think of that as a lamp with a lampshade. That is a light bulb. So the professional term describing a light bulb is a lamp, you know, lamping of fixtures. So that's a big change. We've had some real technology improvements over the years. We went to from the incandescent, where you get this wire, you heat it up really hot, and while it's losing enormous amounts of current, it glows. So you turn the electricity into heat. And as that filament, or that little skinny wire, heats up, it actually gives off light, or lumens, L-U-M-E-N-S, which is a quantity of illumination, light, whatever. I don't know how to describe it without getting too technical. Now we come forward and we get fluorescent lights, and then we get LED light emitting diodes, which are electronic things that glow and don't really get hot. So we've got LED bulbs, we've got halogen bulbs, CFL compact fluorescent, which is nothing more than those long fluorescent tubes bent all around into a squiggly light bulb thing. So it's called CFL compact fluorescent light. Now you get into, with me, here we go, you get into, well, what's the temperature of the lamp? What's the temperature of that thing? You know, well, temperature gets to do with the color of the light, C-O-L-O-R, the color of the light. So 2,700 degrees is kind of a yellowish tint. Then you get up to 3,000 and it gets a little whiter, brighter, bluer. You know, you can get them up to 3,500 degree, and I think it's Kelvin. It's really hot stuff. And this is not heat given off, but is the color associated with that color of the light or illumination. You can get up to 4,000 temperature and all that. So just be aware, a different color or temperature of light is not a measure of how much illumination or brightness that you get in your kitchen or bathroom. It is a type of, it's almost just like a paint color. The brighter, lighter it is, the more generally harsh it is, the more yellowish and softer. You and I think of that as low illumination or not so bright. Don't get that mixed up. You can have a ton of light at 2700 degree Kelvin temperature, but you have to have more illumination, more lumens coming off of that. So anyway, we can talk about that and more, but light bulbs are a big deal. You and I shut inside these houses in these cold temperatures. You know, that's all important. Phone lines here, 314-436-7900, 436-7900, 800-925-1120. Keep in mind, next week is a seminar on kitchens, February 9th, next Saturday, MAC West, Missouri Athletic Club, right there on De Pere. If you want to RSVP, 10:30 on Saturday morning, RSVP to callmosby.com, C-A-L-L-M-O-S-B-Y. And no commitments. It just people are there to answer questions, and it's kind of an extension of this radio show. Anyway, stay tuned. We've got more coming up next here on KMOX. Scott Mosby at your service.
Welcome back to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, once again, here's your host, Scott Mosby on KMOX.
All right, welcome back. Hour two, another half hour before we go up to lots of fun here. I think Rick Edelman coming up next. Stay tuned. The Blues are on tonight at 6 o'clock, 5:30 pregame. They're playing in Columbus tonight. Lots of things happening. Right now, let's go see what's happening with my friend Tom. Tom, good afternoon. Welcome to KMOX. How can I help?
Hey, I've got a door that goes into like a bedroom or a den. Mm-hmm. It swings open to the left when it goes in.
Okay.
I want it to swing open to the right. Now, this is an older home, so, I mean, buying a pre-hung door isn't going to work. Can I take that same door and just switch the hinges and put everything on the other side to have it swing open to the right? I mean, is that going to be a major problem to do that?
Not really. Are you painting the door and the door frame when you're done?
Yes.
Yeah, you're in pretty good shape then, because what you're doing, if you had a pre-hung door and you disconnected that from the door and you rotated the thing 180 degrees, it would actually swing onto the, instead of swinging into the bedroom, it would now swing out into the hall. So you're okay. In pretty good stead. If you have old-time real jam and casing, the one thing you have to realize is that when that carpenter hung that door or put that frame in, there wasn't any trim on it. He put a whole lot, or she put a whole lot of extra fasteners, likely nails and shims, on the hinge side and then reinforced the strike side where the doorknob is on the other side. So if you're going to rehinge this door, I would start by removing probably the interior casing or trim all three sides, and then looking at what you've got on the things, because now you're going to move from your three points of hinge on your left side, let's say, and move it. You're going to have to put shims and screws or nails at those same hinge places before you move the door. So you've got to make that frame suitable structurally to carry that door. You follow me so far?
Right. Well, it's a hollow core door, okay?
Well, still, I mean, you get 30 years of a leverage, you know, a 30-inch door hanging on there. You're still, you know, even those old jams, just, you know, a little ounce of prevention beats a pound of cure. So right. All I'm asking is an extra 10
or
15.
Are you saying also maybe I could just keep it and just have it open outside instead of inside?
No, this is just, you can pull the door off. I am saying yes, that what you're trying to do and the way you're trying to do it will work. In addition to that, I just want you to strengthen the door frame before you move the hinges to the other side.
Okay. Well, it seems to be about the same strength. I mean, when I, you know, look at it, I mean, there doesn't seem to be much difference in either side as far as that goes. And I guess I can buy one of those little, there's a tool I know that you can use. You can tap into it to make the indentation for the hinge to go into?
Yes. Okay. The mortising of that hinge depth. Now, be really aware here. One thing that's easy to mess up, Tom, is the distance that the door hinges are from the edge of the door frame or jam itself. So if that's 360, follow that. And that, you know, so You'll figure this out. I mean, the only thing I'm suggesting is make sure that you fortify or reinforce that other side of the door, because it's not common for carpenters to put an extra screw, blue, and tattoo on the strike side either.
Right, I understand. Now, what about that tool that I'm talking about? Is that something that's expensive or?
Well, you may not need that. It's handy. First off, decide whether you're going to replace your hinges or not, because
right.
they aren't all exactly the same. But as you move them around, you can measure from the top. Do all your measurements from the top of the door frame. So you'd be 8.5 inches or whatever it is to the top of that first hinge, and then you might be 31.5 inches to the top of the second hinge, and then down to the bottom. If you have a three hinge door, likely you might be, 70 inches from the top. Make all your measurements from the top of that door jamb to size and locate those hinges, and then be very accurate with the setback from the edge of the jamb to match the one on the other side. And then as far as mortising that out, you can do that with a good sharp wood chisel, because this is going to be old hardwood, probably old pine, and that nail-on impression device you're describing may have some troubles. You could really bang that hinge, that frame loose, pounding on it with that. I'm going to suggest you do it in the old school of using a sharp wood chisel.
So just take the hinge and draw an outline of it, probably. So
yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
And then just figure out, the way to do this is then I start by, I mark the three sides of the hinge, and then I go straight in with a square cut all the way around, marking all those three sides, and then I angle my hinge about 45 degrees, and I just go all the way up that 3 or 3.5 inch height, chopping in approximately 1/8 inch deep all the way up, and then I scrape it out, and then it's pretty much wood carving to remove that depth or mortise depth of those hinges. Follow so far? Yep. Okay, anyway, it's a big deal, but yes, it's possible there. No worries, Tom. I think this is something you can try. If you mess it up, just, somebody can fix it. How about Ed? Let's see if we still have Ed with us there. Ed, are you there? How can I help?
Hey, Scott. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
We moved into this home, and the home has an addition on the back part of the house. Mm-hmm. And the airflow of the furnace does not reach the back part of the home.
Yes.
Is there any way we can increase that airflow, or is it, can we run another piece of pipe off of the, because it's only got one duct for all the airflow in the home.
Do you have a return duct as well? You have one supply going out there. Do you have a return duct coming back?
No, we don't. Not in that
room, yeah.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, that's the issue, is then the design of that, the return flow is the open door. So if that door ever gets closed, there is no airflow, because when you're blowing air into that room without a return and the door is closed, you're just trying to blow up a balloon. And
okay.
it's not going to move. So the answer is yes, you can size up that ductwork. You need a pretty good heating and cooling contractor to help you on this. This is what I call, somebody put heat in there because they thought they should. I don't think they ever did a heat load or flow calculation on that duct. So chances are you're going to need a lot of duct work, probably at least two supplies out there and at least one return. And you already have one. You're going to need one more supply and at least one return. If those aren't possible to get, then the next answer, and this is probably why they just put one out there, you're looking at a supplemental heating system out there. Your chances are you're likely not going to get comfort on an appendage room, because not only do you only have one duct out there, usually those rooms only, they have a lot of outdoor surfaces. So on a room addition, you've got, four outside sides. You've got left, rear, and right, and then you have the ceiling too, sometimes crawl space, and you wind up, it loses a lot of heat, and you need a lot more flow than the rest of the house. So you following what I mean? It probably needs more
sir.
Than...
I understand that.
Yeah, you're already feeling the effects of it.
Oh, yeah. So, and what I was going to also point out was, The furnace is in the older part of the house, but it's on, way on the other end. So that would that affect it also or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my answer on this one here, Ed, is don't even try and airflow this thing. You're on a supplemental heating and cooling system, period. If your furnace is that far away and it's already a long way without this room addition, then you put the room addition on and then you underserve it with only one supply. If you put 3, 4, or 5 air ducts on there, you're still not going to get the airflow that you need to that addition. If you really want to fix this, I would get a through-the-wall supplemental or a split system heating and cooling unit if you really want this thing to work.
Okay, Scott, I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, and don't trust that, but kind of follow that as your master as you go to solve this, because you know, you can look at the ductwork, but I'm 98% sure you're going to come to a, boy, more ductwork isn't going to fix this. We just need more BTUs out here, and we need to be able to control, you know, because your house might gain and lose, you know, at 1,000 BTUs per hour, but that exterior room addition appendage might need 1,500 BTUs per hour, so you just need a ton more, and one thermostat just is never going to resolve those two differences. Go get them. All right, thanks. Appreciate it. Good question. Let's take a short pause and take a break here on CamOX. Thanks for joining me here, and stay tuned for more on CamOX. We've got a few more minutes of the Home Improvement Show coming up soon.
Welcome back to the Helitech Foundation Repair Home Improvement Show. Now, once again, here's your host, Scott Mosby, on CamOX.
All right. Thanks. It's been a lot of fun. 2 hours on home improvement. Stay tuned. More coming up next on KMOX 6 o'clock. The Blues play tonight in Columbus. Next, let's talk to my friend Nancy. Hey, Nancy. Good afternoon. How can we help?
Hi. I live in a condominium that has a mansard roof and dormers on the vertical mansard side of the roof. And the dormers have a lot of damage due to water infiltration. The design of the dormers was poor. There were no drip edges, so the water just kind of goes back against the wood panels and then rots it out and gets inside the walls of the individual condominium units. Mm-hmm. We also have problems with our shingles because the last contractor put defective shingles on there with no nails, and I think they're supposed to have 6 nails on the vertical side of the roof. So those the shingles that haven't fallen are being held in place by angels. So with one of the contractors who has bid on the project or they're talking about thinking, considering, has said we need to have copper eyebrows, but they need to take the shingles off to put flashing, copper flashing back there, and that you really need to take all the shingles off the vertical side in order to do that because the shingles are bad for one thing, and secondly, you're not going to be able to match all the shingles if you take a whole bunch of them. We have a lot of dormers. And he also was going to put PVC instead of wood panels on the side. And then if he replaces that part of the roof, they would do water and ice protection and check the boards underneath to make sure that they're okay. Now, that sounds very good to me, but some people are saying they'd rather hire non-union people, and maybe you don't want to get into union or non-union, but who might do it for less. And I'm more concerned about getting people who have experience and are qualified to do the job and do it right. And I don't know that you can cut corners here in what this one contractor says you need to do, and that's why I'm calling. It seems to me that sounds like what you need to do to repair dormers.
Absolutely. You already know the answer. And this is not a union versus non-union. This is a right way to do it, comprehensive, painful, expensive, or just do what you did before. Well, you see where that took you. If you can't do flashing without removing the shingles. Sounds like the shingles need to come off. They're falling off anyway, as you're describing, being held on by angels. So welcome to my world. If you don't do this comprehensive thing, it is still going to be a lot of money. and you're going to have to do it again. If you think it's expensive stripping all this stuff off and paying for it the first time, try paying for it twice. So, I mean, again, this is the old, you know, that's an old selling line, but it is ever true. Stick by your guns here, Nancy. Okay. This is about whether you're going to really pony up and fund a solution or whether you're just going to pay some money and hope it works out. And I couldn't be more adamant on this issue, because this is how mistakes get made. This is where a third of my business comes from, is people hoping the low dollar is going to work. By golly, then they have to come back and pay us the second time the number that the first guy wanted to do anyway. You know, I can't be. Have them give me a call. I don't have a dog in this fight. Okay. For heaven's sakes, if they don't do this, they're really going to pay some money and have some pain and mess with their home condo owners. And it is politically very difficult to take a more bid than a less bid. Yeah. Good luck with that. But wouldn't have called me if you didn't know the answer.
Right. Well, since we don't have licensing requirements, when you do contracting or you go out for this thing, how do you prove that people have the experience and the qualifications to do the job? What would you ask for?
Exactly what you described to me, how people are going to do. I mean, frankly, we presented to condo associations a big dog and pony show of what happens if you do it and what happens if you don't do it. And frankly, this contractor knows what's going on. You need to politically fight this fight, but you can't really tell the story of what needs to be done and why. I think to get that kind of political support to spend that kind of money, you really have to have the contractor present to the condo owners at an association meeting. And it is painful. It is not fun. It is emotional. Some people can't afford that money, you know, at this point in their, you know, it's just a big deal. I know what you're talking about, but if you don't do this right, you will you'll have more damage, go down the line even more, and then pay for it again.
Okay. I appreciate that. I wanted to get somebody else to say I was right so I can be more confident.
Well, I'll give you the other projection going forward. Only about half of these get done this way. People just don't want to spend the money, and they'd rather close their eyes. There's something in human nature about that. So, you know, just because you're going to launch this ship doesn't mean it's going to get to the other port.
That's right.
Good luck.
Well, thank you so much.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Take care, Nancy. All right, next up, let's see what's cooking with my buddy Mark here. Hey, Mark, Scott, how can I help you?
Hi, Scott. I've got a plumbing retrofit question. I'm looking to add a wet bar down in the basement.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what I'd like to do is, there's an existing drain from the washing machine on the first floor.
Yep.
And I'd like to just tap into that drain for the bar sink. Do you anticipate any problems with doing that?
Yep.
That's the reason I called.
Yep. First off, that standpipe for the drain actually has a P-trap underneath the floor. So the technically good place to connect that is break up the concrete floor and put your bar drain downstream of that, because the P-trap belongs on the underneath the sink for your bar sink there. Unless you get on the other side of the P-trap that's under the floor there, you're doing this the wrong way. So that, and the down part of the plumbing pipe is, unless this is a temporary thing, because a home inspector will knock you on this, you'll have to pull this stuff out before selling the house because it's not correct. And you've got a vent requirement that when the water goes down, even if you break the floor and do it this way, you still have to vent that thing up either through the roof or tie in to the waste lines or vent lines above any water flow, which means above a sink on the main floor or second floor of your house.
So it's not possible to use a mechanical vent past the P-trap under the sink before
it is, but
you tie into that?
It is, but it's seldom accepted by code. It's considered a do-it-yourself, a temporary method. It will be flagged by a home inspector, especially a licensed home inspector, as to be checked by a professional plumber. Professional plumber will say, you know, so whether it works or not doesn't mean that it's code approved and that a buyer is going to allow it to pass.
Right. Yeah, I didn't see any reason why it wouldn't work, but I was worried about the code part of it, and I hadn't been able to find anything that definitely told me one way or the other. But so, how do you know where to break up the concrete to tie into existing drain under all that cement?
It'll be pretty close to that. Those standpipes generally just miss the footing down in the basement, so that standpipe will come straight down, have 180 turn on it, and go right in. So you're going to be within 2 feet of the bottom of that standpipe, most common. And this down in the basement where the concrete is, for clarity?
Yes, yes.
You'll find that there, but realize you now have to go up with a vent pipe for the makeup air. Let's pretend you dump a whole bunch of water down that sink. Well, that's going to push all the air ahead of it. It needs a vent or makeup air behind that slug of big water for it to flow freely. So that's the purpose of vents, is basically makeup air behind the slug of that water. Got it there? All right. Good luck, Mark. You're into big stuff. Do more research, or preferably even get a licensed plumber to do it, because you can get into a big deal. And if you don't get a licensed plumber, you wind up ripping it out because it comes up at the home inspection time and has to be removed. Stay tuned. More coming up on KMOX. Scott Mosby at your service. I had fun. Thanks.